All right, welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast. We are talking with Dr. Matthew Camarillo. Thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yes, sir. Can you give us a brief rundown about what you talked about today?
Yeah, today my topic was on shoulder overuse injuries. And, you know, it's a broad topic, and I kind of try to narrow it down more to the athletic population, kind of looking at, you know, rotator cuff pathology, meaning shoulder impingement type syndromes, which is, you know, a broad array of multiple different things. And when you have a syndrome, it's probably meaning you don't really know what caused it, but you just have multiple causes for it, and you can have intrinsic, extrinsic type things that lead to it, as well as some bicep tendonitis, glenohumeral internal rotation deficit, and then kind of more for the adolescent population, the little leaguer shoulder.
Okay. So, a lot of our audience, physical therapists, athletic trainers, just what are some examination ideas or some symptoms from a history that we should be kind of keying in on for these types of issues?
Yeah, you know, most of the time when someone comes in with shoulder pain, you know, they have dull shoulder pain, they're not coming in, it's there and wait till it really gets extreme. And then the nighttime pain is the one that kind of sets patients off, that they say, all right, or an athlete, all right, I couldn't sleep last night because my shoulder hurts so bad. That's the kind of thing where you start saying and knowing, did this just happen to something? Did you make a throw? Did you do something? Is this an acute injury, or is it kind of a gradual onset that makes you think? And then just kind of breaking down the history, what activities cause it? Is it only when I'm going overhead? Is it only when I'm weightlifting? Is it only when I throw? And kind of breaking down what's causing the pain. And if you can figure out that area, I think that leads you in the right idea. And I really stress on the history and physical exam, because I think it's a whole lot better than going through this broad approach of we need to get x-rays and MRIs on everything with this huge shotgun approach. Let's just MRI the entire neck, chest, arm, and everything and figure it out, because MRIs are good, but sometimes they're too good and they're going to give you something. The last thing you want to do is MRI a Major League Baseball pitcher's shoulder. I mean, that you're going to find something, right? But then what do you do with that?
Right. So let's kind of delve into subacromial impingement a little bit. Is impingement not just a normal daily happening? I mean, when two things come in contact with each other, that's impingement, right?
Right, right. Right.
So then when does it start to take into the next level?
It starts when you always have that bursa, the subacromial bursa, and it always sits above the rotator cuff. For some reason, and I don't have the answer, and I don't think anyone does, for some reason the rotator cuff gets inflamed, or the bursa gets inflamed. And normally you have about 10 millimeters of, if you look on an x-ray, between the humeral head and the acromion. And then as things start getting inflamed, that space decreases. And we know when there's less than 5 millimeters, that's really when you start getting impingement syndrome. So there's inflammation in there. And when that 5 millimeter marks hit, then that's when you start developing symptoms. But a lot of times we don't know what caused it. And that's the hardest part, is you have to try to figure out. And sometimes you don't know, but you know, if you can get everything calmed down in that area, then you can restore mechanics. And I think one thing you think about is there's 26 muscles in the shoulder. As soon as one gets out of whack, the entire kinematics of the shoulder is completely disrupted. And then you're just going down this huge path until you hit a reset on the shoulder.
There's bound to be some superior migration. So for that for that space to decrease,
right?
What spots in the shoulder, as a therapist, a trainer, what areas should we try and address to see if we can eliminate, reduce, or prevent that superior migration?
And I think a lot of it, if it's superior migration because of rotator cuff tear, there's not a whole lot you can do, but I think a lot of it is more tightness in that posterior capsule. I really think a lot of people have tight posterior capsules from adaptation, especially when the shoulder's been hurting for a while. They stop using the kinematics right. And what it does is it moves the humeral head to a more anterior position, and it leads to tightness. So if we can really stretch out that posterior capsule, I think that's really the mainstay of helping the humeral head sit more in a neutral position instead of that high riding anterior superior position.
And so if somebody's been diagnosed with a subacromial impingement, is a subacromial decompression always the answer?
I would say never. That can be highly debated. And I actually had an article published last month saying that maybe these patients do better. But if you looked at the study, they actually didn't do a subacromial decompression. They did an acromioplasty. So they added more room by taking out acromion, but they didn't do a true subacromial decompression. Is just going out and taking out the bursa. But that's not what they did in the study. And I've seen very few that have ever done any better just going through there. I think the mainstay is you can go in and do that, but if you still don't fix the underlying pathology, you're still not going to get any better.
So you mentioned with that different migration, potentially with that posterior capsule, you're going to have some anterior migration, and there's a structure right there in front that limits anterior migration of the biceps tendon, right?
Yeah.
And so you mentioned a lot about the biceps potentially being a tendonitis issue, an area like that. Can you kind of delve on that a little bit?
Yeah. So the bicep tendon is one of the few things in the shoulder that I think gives you an exact point. You really can't point ever to the rotator cuff and say it hurts here. No, that's the rotator cuff. But the bicep tendon is pretty predictable. The whole point right in that area, and it can tender in there. And a lot of times the bicep tendon is inflamed when it sits in that bicipital groove. You can actually, if you internally externally rotate the shoulder, you can actually feel it moving in and out of the groove because it's so inflamed. So it's just one of those things where it's a pretty pinpoint one that you can make a pretty straightforward diagnosis when they have anterior shoulder pain. Other thing patients come in and talk about that is my shoulder's popping. Every time I externally rotate or I get behind my back, then my shoulder's popping in and out. I don't think I've ever seen a patient pop their shoulder in and out of place multiple times with those positioned at the arm at the side, but that's really the one structure, I think, in the shoulder that you can get true popping in that area.
You can get a localized pain that you said is referred to the actual thing versus like with the rotator cuff will go
give
down
you
to
a
the
deltoid,
deltoid and you don't really know. People say, well, there's a muscle that's tight in my lateral shoulder.
Yeah.
Well, it's not your deltoid that you just mess with. Yeah. Okay, so chicken or the egg. Do you have biceps tendonitis because of the biceps overuse, or do you have other issues in the shoulder that lead to bicep tendonitis?
I think it's other issues that probably lead to that. I think the posterior capsule, I think a lot of times people have that. I think they have inherent rotator cuff tendonitis. And a lot of times, sometimes I don't know the answer, but I know if I can I can get everything calmed down and we restore it, then we can get it to go away. But sometimes you don't know. You know, a lot of times people, I started CrossFit and I've been doing all these overhead activities. Well, is it the bicep tendon that got inflamed from that? Or did the rotator cuff get inflamed and now we're having a migration of the humeral head? Sometimes I don't know. But I think if you can kind of get everything calmed down and then restore the mechanics and take away that inciting event again, then you can restore everything. But a lot of times, I don't know is the short answer.
Sure, sure. So let's take it a step further. Let's say we have either a young athlete, an athlete in the middle of his prime, or one towards the end. You know, we have these two procedures as a therapist. I see them a lot. You have the biceps tendinitis and the tenotomy.
Mm-hmm.
Can you kind of give me an idea just for people who are in that position or, you know, potentially see it a lot, what's the each direction and the benefit and cost benefit of each?
Yeah. So the tendinitis, all you're doing is simply cutting the bicep and you're just kind of letting it flow. The biggest thing with that is you have no anchor point to that head of the bicep at that point. So the biggest thing that you get with that is if it doesn't have an anchor point, every time you activate the bicep, you get a lot of muscle spasms. You also get a huge cosmetic deformity because you get that reverse Popeye. So I think really the mainstay, and, you know, first started arthroscopic surgery of the shoulder, we didn't have great ideas. We knew we could go in and clip the bicep, but you didn't know what to do it after. Now we have techniques where you can tendinitis, and I think that's really fallen in favor in the literature across the board, is to go in and tendinitis and give it a sticking point of where it needs to go to try to establish the link tension curve of the bicep. Then you can debate, should you do it arthroscopically or should you do it subpec? You know, I think each have their benefit. I'm a big believer if the bicep tendon is the pathology, you want to get it completely out of the shoulder joint. So I like the subpec tendinitis. You know, used to we had to make these huge incisions and things to do that. You can do that through a 3 to 4 centimeter incision. And I just think you can more equally establish the link tension curve by looking directly at the bicep tendon. And I think you get a little more secure fixation and you get the entire pathology out of the shoulder joint.
You improve the bicep function, but what are you doing to the shoulder function? Are you losing anything by losing that bicep tendon?
If you look at it biomechanically, would I do it in a thrower shoulder? No.
Okay.
But most people that aren't doing a lot of overhead activity, I think is fine. I think day to day you would not notice a difference. I think a thrower shoulder would be completely different. That I don't think I've seen anything that would support doing that in a thrower shoulder.
So, I mean, in general, you're not going to increase chances for laxity, MDI, or anything like that.
Nothing.
If
that,
you want to stay active, you know, throwers, obviously, there's a little bit more stress, especially in the lay-pack position, things like that. But just the, you know, general population, we're not, you know.
No, I don't think so. Like no, and I think it has some benefit on certain slap tears, too. When you have an unstable bicep anchor, I think in a 40, 50-year-old, I think that's the way to go than going with a slap repair. Honestly, I think the recovery is easier, and there's been no shown sign in the literature of decreased function or increased instability with that. So I think it's a great treatment modality as far as – I think the only part that can be debated is should you do arthroscopic or should you do open, and if you get – 10 orthopedic surgeons in the room, you'll probably get 50-50 on it.
Oh, excellent. You always like the ones that don't have the – everybody has the same answer. Right. So whenever you have these issues, these syndromes, you mentioned the shotgun approaches, get the X-ray, get the MRI, just test everything. And you talked a little bit about diagnostic ultrasound. I've seen that a couple of clinics that I ran with. Can you kind of speak on that a little bit as something that people are using now?
Yeah, I think it's a newer thing in sports medicine, but I think it's a great modality because there's no radiation associated with it. It's something you can use in the office, and there's unless you're doing an injection with it, there's nothing invasive with it. And it is, I found as I'm starting to roll that out of my practice, it's relearning. You learn how to read X-rays. You learn how to read CT scans. Now I'm having to learn how it looks on an ultrasound machine. And each ultrasound machine is different depending on the depth they can go and its field. You have to really know what you're looking for. And I think, you know, and if you look at the literature coming out of Korea, they're diagnosing and treating rotator cuff tears based on ultrasound instead of going through the cost of doing an MRI. I had a patient actually come over from Korea for a second opinion, and they show up with an ultrasound about 5 years ago, and I'm looking at them like, I have no idea how to read this. And so, but they had never had an MRI, but they had told them that they had a rotator cuff tear based on that. So I think there is some use of the ultrasound. I think it's a quick diagnostic tool that you can use. Will it work for deeper structures? Maybe you can get to the hip and things like that. Is it done work in the knee to diagnose an ACL tear? No, it's probably not that good. But can you do shoulder? And it's all about positioning. Can you get the shoulder in the right position to visualize the anatomy?
More superficial.
Right.
Is there any benefit to it being that you can actually move? You know, you have the dynamic MRIs and things like that.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great thing because a lot of times if you're getting a static MRI, the patient's staying in one position, and then you don't know what's happening because they're like, no, it pops when I do this. Right. Well, a lot of times you can't reproduce that. You can't reproduce that in an MRI machine. You can't have them go through a full throwing motion. But if you can get on that anatomy and follow it through, I think that has some great benefit to do.
Yeah, kind of just jumping off topic for a second. You know, you hear a lot about patellar tracking issues. Mm-hmm. Right, and all these kids with you know bad mechanics having these tibial osteotomies and things like that, and they're looking at how the knee moves. And you can also just kind of mention the biceps tendon kind of popping out of the groove. Does the ultrasound, diagnostic ultrasound, have a way of kind of getting a better look at how things are moving during those types of symptoms and syndromes and things like that?
You can, as long as you get good position on it. Yeah. And it has such a limited view that you have a field of view on it that you have to really have it in a good position to watch it dynamically move. But if, especially in the bicep tendon, you can. Patella tendon as well, it's something. The quad tendon, you can see. Rotator cuff, you can actually, if you put the shoulder in the right position, you can actually see the mechanics of the shoulder moving. Could you get down to the labral area? I haven't seen one that's that strong, but I think these superficial things, I think it does show some promise. The biggest thing is making sure that we can get a good field through a vision through the whole procedure.
And so when we talked about throwers, you mentioned GERD being something that's definitely common with a lot of throwers, repetitive movements and things like that. Physical therapists, we have different viewpoints, different blogs, different articles that are coming out that talk about posterior capsule versus posterior cuff and the tightness between both. You know, when you have repetitive, especially eccentric control of those muscles of the posterior rotator cuff, how they can tighten up as well.
Right.
I know Reinhold out there with Andrews does a lot of studies with baseball players, and he kind of showed that just like right after throwing a game, there's a loss of interrotation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, does that mean that the cuff can tighten up that quickly? Does that mean that the capsule can get that kind of tightness and become taut to create those symptoms down the road? What's your thoughts on the cuff versus capsule issues?
You know, I think it's probably a combination of both. And I think what it is it's the shoulders inflamed. You're getting that tightness and that adhesions in that area because of the overuse, and you have chronic inflammation. And what's the body going to do as it's in the healing process? It's going to start healing that area. And so I think it's probably a combination of both and not one or the other. I think with the sleeper stretch and our standard – GERD treatments, we're probably stretching out both. I don't think we can kid ourselves and say we're only stretching out the capsule or with this move we're only stretching out the posterior cuff. They're sitting right there that you're probably going to stretch both. So I think it's probably a combination of both.
Yeah, and there's, you know, the different approaches, whether you do the crossbody stretch or the sleeper stretch or the, you know, the where you kind of roll over your shoulder and kind of go into a sleeper stretch. Hopefully, as a healthcare provider, we're picking the one that creates the least amount of symptoms, right? The one that you want to stretch the area and get the area that you're trying to target to feel the symptoms, not, okay, now I'm getting superior or anterior pain in my shoulder.
Right.
Oh, but I was told to do this.
Right.
So, yeah, having multiple options to get to those areas.
Yeah. I think any therapy, you know, as an orthopedic surgeon, I probably have the easy job. I have to come up with a diagnosis or come up with a treatment plan, but then it's up to the therapist and the patient to enact that treatment plan. But I think any physical therapy is per patient, and there's no textbook therapy for any patient, and you really have to adapt. And that's when you have the best outcome, when you have a team approach and you're adaptable to that patient. I think that's when you have the best outcome. So, you know, if one hurts, then we can adapt to something else, and you don't always have to stick by the cookbook or the textbook way of doing things.
Yeah, and GERD, I would say it's taught like a subacromial impingement, that it's a pretty broad approach, because when you have a loss of internal rotation, you can definitely have it from that posterior tightness, but also with just morphological changes, having more layback, you're going to have a difference in throwing side versus non-throwing side.
Right.
You know, what's the range that you look at to say, okay, this person has this much layback, right? I know there's a total motion arc that you want to cover. But as a clinician, and you're looking at them in the clinic, what are you looking for between the two sides?
I'm looking, you know, still in a throw, I'm still looking at 20 to 30 degrees. If there's a difference, and I like having them lay down, and you can really get the scapula stabilized on the table and really just kind of letting them lay down, you can really tell it. And a lot of times you don't even need a goniometer, I mean, because they're that extreme. If you're having to get out a goniometer and see, are we at 20, are we at 30, you're probably not at a huge, you know, you're at some kind of deficit. But if you're looking at, are we 5 to 10% different? There's probably not a huge difference. But if it's a obvious one, and I really like it when they're laying down, and I like the parent sitting at the foot of the bed where they can really see what we're talking about, because it's one of those things where you can actually show them, hey, there's a huge difference. Have them take a picture and say, hey, look at the difference between your shoulders. I think that goes a long way, because they can actually see something out of that physical exam, and it kind of hits home at that point.
Yeah, you mentioned how parents are involved sometimes a little bit too much in their athletes, their kids, sports progressions. How are you dealing with parents and kids and the thoughts that they may have to slow down a little bit or recover a little bit?
Well, I always tell them, I think sometimes you have the over-anxious parents. Sometimes they're scared to go tell the coach because they're – and I said, it's easy. I get to be the bad guy. Yeah. And you put it all on me, because my job is not to get you back for the Little League game on Saturday. It's to make sure that you have a good functional shoulder for the rest of your life. And I think that's one of the things that hits home, that we're not looking – for them to play a game tomorrow. We're looking so that they have a good shoulder and they can throw a baseball to their kid when they're in their 30s and 40s. And I think that's the biggest thing. I have to look in the long term. I don't look for the short term. Now, if they're making $15 million a season, it's a different conversation. But when you're in elementary, middle school, and you may not go to the major leagues, and we have to think about what else are you going to do, and you need probably a functional shoulder to do that.
Right. Yeah, you the old adage, you don't sign a scholarship when you're 10 years old.
Yep, yep.
Right, and so I think
I guess unless you're from A&M now, they're all.
Well, they are offered pretty early. But there are programs, right? There's the Pitch Smart program.
Yep.
You know, as a parent, as a coach, hopefully there's ways that they can look into these leagues. Are they following these rules? Do you have any resources that parents or coaches or trainers can look into to make sure that they can kind of keep
Yeah, I mean, they have, Baseball USA has the thing for pitch counts. I think that's probably the one to go through, because it's really, you know, Jimmy Andrews spent a lot of time on doing that and had great research coming out. It's just, I don't know a way to hold all these little leagues accountable for that, and especially if a kid plays on two teams, you can't hold one coach accountable because they were doing something else. And it, you know, it really falls to the parents to look at the health of the shoulder. Like I said, my nephew this weekend wanted to show me how he learned how to throw a changeup and breaking ball, and it's like, you're 11. So we'll have a talk with the coach on Saturday.
Right.
So it's not an isolation. It happens, you know, things that you don't know about is dad's a baseball football coach. He had no idea that he was like, So, you know, it's some of those things if you're not. But, you know, you start picking up on these nuances. But I think it comes back to you really have to do your research. And I'm still a big fan of not year-round sports. I think at that age, it's too soon to specialize. Let them go play basketball. Let them go play another sport.
Cross training, right?
Yep, and give some rest to the arm.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I've had conversations with, and it seems pretty simple in my head, is that a fastball from the mound is just as detrimental. Excuse me, the other way around. A throw from third or short to first is just as detrimental from a fastball from the mound. They think, oh, if he's not pitching, he can go to position. And usually the pitchers are one of the better position players.
Right.
So as soon as they're off the mound, oh, well, you can't pitch. Okay, then go play short.
Yep.
The guy who gets the most throws other than the catcher and the pitcher, right?
Right. Yeah.
And so they don't kind of connect that to, oh, my son's not pitching.
Right.
So, but he's playing the infield or he's playing the outfield. Well, it's the same thing. You're still making those hard throws.
Yep.
And so,
and you're still making throws to warm up and everything.
Right,
yep.
So it's tough. And I'm not saying there's an easy answer.
Yep.
But as a doctor and as a clinician, you know, there's got to be some sort of, you know, delineation between, you know, rest and recovery that we can kind of carry over and teach and educate these students and athletes, because they want to play.
Right.
Right?
Yep.
And then you have the parents who are saying, well, how can you get them to play as soon as possible? So how are you dealing with the potential, you know, the injections and the things that kind of calm them down, right? What do you come across in that regard?
So, you know, the main thing, I never get pressured into the fact of how fast can we get them back to play. Because like I said, I have to look at the long-term health of their shoulder. And, you know, it's sometimes you spend more time on the counseling part than you do the physical examiner thing, because you can pick up on if they have an internal rotation deficit or they have a little leaguer shoulder, that's pretty, you know, quick diagnosis, but it's more time calming the parents down and saying, look, we got to look at this. We got to do this smart way. Or if you push him, we're going to end right back up in this thing. If we take a month off and then we're going to skip into therapy, but we skip that, we just let him, he took the month off and go back into throwing, then we're just going to end right back in the situation. We're just going to do this vicious cycle over and over again. And really, a lot of the time, it's more counseling during the office visit than it is physical exam or diagnosis of the patient. It's more the counseling of how can you approach, but you have to approach. It's tough in a first time meeting a parent, figure out what approach you have to take. You have to kind of feel them out of which approach you have to go, but you have to be able to, just like therapy has to be per patient, you have to approach each patient and patient family differently too, and kind of figure out what approach works. There's always the option of, you know, you make for sure if they don't like your idea, you send them to someone you think is cool as a second opinion too, where they're probably going to hear the same thing.
So that, you know, I know a lot of times it's helpful as a trainer and a therapist to be on the same page as the physician. Hmm. So here's the scenario. We're presented with a kid, an athlete, or an individual who has shoulder pain. And we feel like they'd be best referred to a clinician, a physician, to get a better assessment. They're going to ask us immediately, typically, what's my time frame? So I'm going to give you the opportunity to help us be all on the same page. In general, what do you feel like, if you got to shut somebody down, what their time frame would be?
Yeah, so for just, you know, overworked shoulder, things like that, separate of the little leaguer shoulder, because that's truly fractured. The other ones, it's a minimum of, you come in with shoulder pain, elbow pain, and a thrower, it's a minimum time of a month that you're getting shut down. You're not, and it all depends on what's bothering it. If they're having problems with batting and everything like that, they're just completely shut down from all athletics, all overhead stuff for a month. We're just kind of shutting everything down. There'll be exceptions where, you know, if they're not having a whole lot of pain, if they can bat, things like that, sometimes that can be debatable. But for a minimum, if they're coming in with especially a pitcher or overhead, they're shut down for a month. And there's really no debate in my mind on that. It's a minimum of a month. And then they say from there, what are we going to do? Well, from there, we're going to reassess, and we're going to see how we look, and we're going to take it time. So in my mind, I give them the longest possible time frame possible. And then anything other makes you look like we got them back faster. So I think longer is better. You know, if they came in, and initially I won't even give them a time frame when they come in. I'm saying for the first month we're shut down and we'll reassess from there.
And what are you having them do during that first month? Is conservative care, just total rest and
recovery? Just total rest. They're not even, you know, if they're a high school kid, they'll be in the training room just doing some modalities, things like that.
Yeah.
You know, middle school, adolescent kid, they're just shut down. They're just not doing anything. So, but you have to figure it out, because it's like, Well, can I do PE? Well, what are you doing in PE? Oh, we're playing baseball right now. Yeah. So you have to think about all these. Well, he's also on the basketball team. You know, so you have to think about all the scenarios that they may pull out. So I just, across the board, we're shut down from everything. We're out of PE. We have that note, and we just kind of shut down from everything.
Okay. Yes, it's important. I know you get conflicting answers from different facilities, and so you want to make sure as best we can be as close to possible. So that it looks like everybody's on the same page.
Right, right.
So, yeah, it's good to know. About a month for that painful shoulder when throwing and things like that. Is there anything else that you feel like trainers and therapists, whoever's listening, should be kind of up to date on? Anything we should be looking into that you feel like?
No, I mean, I think really shoulder pathology, it can be tough. But I think a good diagnosis and physical exam can really give you all the diagnosis you need. And then you kind of follow it up with the extra imaging studies after that.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Camarillo. Sorry, you got it. We appreciate it. If you guys want to check this out again, sportsmedicine.com/Camarillo2018.